Miami Memoirs presents real case histories and true stories related to the law practice and experiences of Florida attorney Lewis M. Ress. Miami Memoirs uncorks a caseload of true, weird, wonderful, and wild stories from an always eventful 6 decades of life in the law. From multimillion-dollar land deals to the ghostly aftermath of an Everglades plane disaster via a prematurely deep-frozen cat, these tales feature a parade of unforgettable characters, all sharply observed by a storyteller with a very human empathy for ordinary and extraordinary individuals caught up in the law.
Lewis has just released a new book, Miami Memoirs, including The Maharani's Ring. Fans of strange cases and wild tales will need no introduction to the author's brilliant and fast-paced storytelling, laced with salty evocations of the human carnival of the era and shot through with compassionate insight. From advising the heir to Colonel Sanders and falling out with Buddy Hackett to nighttime jogging with Vitas Gerulaitis, the stories keep on coming. Larry the charismatic Wheeler dealer needs to be rescued from yet another risky deal, and a bridge-playing mobster needs help to find his missing daughter. All this and more, along with sage advice against buying a lottery ticket you might win. Welcome to round two. And now, let's begin.
Hi everyone. Welcome to Miami Memoirs, Strange Cases and Wild Tales with Lewis Ress. Today, we're on episode 55, The Parkland Deal. So, Lewis, this story is called The Parkland Deal. Is this the same city where the school massacre happened?
That's right. You're absolutely right.
Oh, wow. Okay. So, what's the story about?
Well, cities just don't happen. They follow geographic landmarks like rivers, valleys. And so if you look at the history of the development of our country, you'll see that most of the cities follow rivers. So you have the Hudson River in New York with New York City and Albany being on the Hudson also. And then all these rivers, if you look at the Mississippi and the Ohio, the cities that have been formed in Pittsburgh is the convergence of two rivers. And that's where mountain trails come together. So they form a town or a city, and it rises generally from one person's efforts. So you have Smithville. It comes after Mr. Smith. And if you look at the history of the cities, they are created in geographic locations for commerce, and they're created by one individual, and then a group of people come in and found it, a religious group or a political group. So Parkland. It goes back to the time when Parkland was farmland. So it wasn't parkland, it was farmland. And the story is about a group, mainly doctors, and they were buying 2,000 acres of land, which is now in the city of Parkland, and it was in the city of Parkland, in West Broward County in southeast Florida. And it was unplatted, it was undeveloped, it was just raw acreage. It had been a sod farm. It was used to grow St. Augustine grass. You know, the grass that we have on our lawns, it comes in big rolls and strips, and the developer unrolls it and puts it on the sand. And that's how you get the lawn.
Oh, I see.
It was, the grass was strip harvested, so it was on muck land.
And easily
the muck was
be
like
able to
about
rip it
5 feet thick when it started. It was all muck. And they grew the grass. It took about 5 inches. And then the new grass was grown on the rich topsoil of the muck. And then gradually, after year, the topsoil was exhausted, and you were down to rock. Then the farmers sold what they thought was barren, useless land to the city slickers. So there was always a hustle. And this story is about dishonesty and hustling and fraud. And the farmers started off selling the land, and that was really they let the city slickers get skinned. That's what they thought. However, civilization had crept out to the sod farms at the edges of Broward County on the west edges, and the property would soon be ready for houses. And houses, it didn't matter. You didn't need 5 feet of muck for houses.
Right.
It was in the way. It was an encumbrance. Mm-hmm. Clearing the muck was good. They scarified the property.
Yeah, they helped
down
them
to
out.
Rock, and they could build on the rock. They had no roads on the property or into it. Ed Trumpet, a plastic surgeon, had found the deal through a friendship with another doctor, Dr. Samuel Paul. Those names are changed. Mm-hmm. And Ed had brought in Kenny Lustig. It's another name change.
Mm-hmm.
He was a neurosurgeon as co-trustees. So Ed and Ken, Ed Trumpet and Ken Lustig were to be compensated as trustees at 2% of the total sale price when the property was sold. Both Ed and Ken were friends of mine and clients of mine. The original purchase price was $900 an acre, or $1.8 million, with a 10% down payment.
Wow.
The trust agreement provided for the trustees to actively market the property and describe the voting procedure for approval of a sale. I was offered a participation of 1.5% for $27,000. That was allowable at the time.
Oh, wow. Okay, so you could be an attorney and then also be an investor.
Right. No more. But in those days,
right.
It was not deemed a conflict of interest. Today, it's an automatic conflict of interest.
Mm-hmm, I can see why.
So the trustee, Ed Trumpet, and Kenny Lustig listed the property with Holland Realty. And within 2 years, Holland Realty obtained an offer for $7,200 an acre with 20% down and a mortgage for the balance.
Hmm. Wow.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah, it sure is.
Over $14 million, almost eight times the original price. Eight
wow.
times. The purchasers were the Prosser family, the richest Jewish family in the United States.
Wow.
They owned vast amounts of real estate. They owned office buildings. They had a major hotel chain. In fact, it was the Hyatt chain. They still own it. And they even had a medical school and a law school named after them. And their local attorney, Martin Barkin, whose name I changed, was a Yale Law School graduate and was very experienced, very competent attorney.
I mean, this was a terrific deal. Eight times your money in 2 years?
That's it.
Yeah.
Right.
And so did the deal go through or?
The deal was accepted.
Okay, good.
And we exchanged the appropriate documents at the closing. And the Prossers were not, and that's not their real name. I'll tell you their real name. It was Pritzker's, and you can know Jay Pritzker is the governor of Illinois, and
okay.
he's a contender for the Democratic nomination for president of the United States if Joe Biden doesn't run.
Oh, okay.
So,
wow.
And Ed Trumpet and Ken Lustig received their trustee compensation of 2% of the down payment and 2% of the monthly checks that we were receiving as the mortgage payments came in. The Prossers made payments for about a year without asking for a partial release of land, and then suddenly nothing. Telephone calls to their attorney, Martin Barkin, went unanswered. Finally, he responded. He couldn't explain why his clients weren't making their mortgage payments, and he suggested that we call them directly. The Prossers' Chicago attorney responded. It was a very clipped conversation. He told us that they were well aware that they had defaulted under the mortgage, and he said nothing else. A number of participants in our group started calling me.
And what did the investors say?
Hey, where's my check? What's going on? Why don't we foreclose? Why don't you do something?
What's the holdup?
Right. And the trustees asked me the same question. Well, one just doesn't foreclose and sue the Pritzkers or the Prossers.
Mm.
It means filing a lawsuit against them. Naming them as a party defendant, saying that they defaulted under a business obligation, filing that in the public records. No, 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 one doesn't do that.
So how did you handle it?
Well, the first thing I did is speak to my client. I spoke to Dr. Trumpet.
Mm-hmm.
I said, Ed, you and I ought to go to Chicago and talk to the Prosser family before we do anything else. And he said, Lewis, what's the point in doing that? What do you expect to accomplish? Ed, we don't have a choice. We have to sit down with them and treat them in a refined manner. We can always sue them. Why make enemies out of the Prossers?
And did he agree?
Well, yeah, he did. He was a very, very smart guy.
Hmm.
Very smart. And we called the Prossers and spoke to them. And we were invited to meet with them for lunch.
Mm, okay.
And I went in their private dining room.
Oh.
I went up to Chicago the day before and did some scouting around. The Prosser family had their own high-rise office building downtown Chicago with offices on the penthouse floor. They were a tight family group of brothers and cousins and uncles. Each participated in making family decisions with a majority rule. Their attorney indicated that he was not required to attend a meeting and it would be hard to get them to reverse a decision. They had arranged for me to have privileges at their private club for dinner, and it was very formal, intimate. It was like a dark lounge in a restaurant with dark brown leather furniture, low lights, and servants appearing out of nowhere to offer you drinks and pick up your glass. There was a rather loud group in the background, and Anita Greenberg moved away from them. That's not her name. I won't tell you her name. She came towards me. Her blue eyes were twinkling. Her blonde hair caught the light. She was a sexy lady with a very low-cut red dress. And she was pretty much bombed. She was inebriated. She had been recently divorced from my dental friend, Harvey. And she put her arms around me. And she said she couldn't believe that she would find me here. She didn't explain what she was doing there over 2,000 miles from home. One of the men called her to come back into their room. And she let loose with a stream of cursing that I rarely, if ever, heard from a woman. She was evidently one of the ladies who could not hold her liquor and became ugly.
Oh, yeah.
The next time I saw her in Miami, she was quiet, very, very well-mannered, and merely mentioned how delightful it was to run into me in Chicago.
Well, that sure is a story within a story there.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, that story goes on even till today.
Oh.
I see her lately. I see her frequently.
Oh, yeah?
And she's very refined and very quiet. And you never know that she was a vulgar, wild person with some alcohol in her. Anyhow, the next morning, Dr. Trumpet arrived right on time, and we went up the glass elevator to the penthouse floor. And the Prossers had their own private dining room. It was small, and they served kosher food. They were Jewish. And the little old Jewish lady, she was short, and she had an apron tied to her chest. She served us chicken soup. The Prosser family was all there. They were plainly dressed in inexpensive white shirts, probably from Costco, tan slacks and brown sweaters. They wore Timex watches with no jewelry. You would never have guessed their wealth and importance. These were really, really, I mean, they were billionaires.
Yeah, they were really understated, huh?
Oh, man, yeah. I'm always impressed when I meet with ultra-rich people. The ultra-rich are generally dressed down, and many of them drive old beat-up cars. And the girls always wear a single strand of pearls and a sweater, very modestly
dressed.
Keep
it simple. Keep it
simple.
Yeah, simple.
They wear very simple clothes. They don't dress like show business people, flashy. And they don't dye their hair flashy, and they don't wear mascara.
Just blend in.
And all that heavy stuff.
Just try to blend in.
Yeah,
right?
they don't want to be noticed.
Yeah. Smart way to go.
Well,
So what did you talk about?
Well, no business was discussed during the simple meal, which featured boiled beef. And afterwards, we met in their conference room. It was all glassed in, and we were facing the lake and the skyscrapers of Chicago. I was really impressed. The table accommodated at least 20 people, but there was only Dr. Trumpet and me in our suits and ties, and Uncle Jack Prosser in a tan cardigan sweater. He got right down to business. He was a nice guy. He said, "Lewis, of course we knew what we were doing when we defaulted. Go ahead and foreclose. Better still, we'll deed back the property to you in lieu of foreclosure. You don't have to sue us. You don't have to file a suit. We'll give you a deed and you release us from the mortgage."
Okay.
"Mr. Prosser," I said to him, "in all due respect, we came here to talk to you about reinstating the mortgage. We won't charge you any penalties or any fees. I don't want a legal fee. All we want to do is save the sale. We don't want to lose the sale. There are widows and older retired investors who rely on this mortgage interest income.
Well, that was a generous offer. How did he react?
He was very nice. He looked at me and he smiled and he said, "Lewis, please, but we have considered that economically it is impossible for us to develop this land at a profit. Here's paper and pen. You push the pencil and show me how we can do it." And that's an expression, push the pencil. I had never heard that before.
Interesting.
I said, "Mr. Prosser, I am not as knowledgeable or experienced or successful as you, and I certainly would not be in a position to question your business judgment. All we ask is that you reconsider." He said, "Mr. Rez, Dr. Trumpet, we've had a vote and we've made up our mind to abandon this project. You can have a deed back." Then I said, "Mr. Prosser, you know that I represent many investors here, and we have no choice but to seek a deficiency judgment in the foreclosure, which we believe will amount to over $350,000. Can we negotiate a compromise amount?" Was that me talking to one of the richest people in the world? And Uncle Jack, who that said they knew him as Uncle Jack, he looked at me, and he looked at me slowly, and he took his forefinger and rubbed it across his temple, and he said, "You know," he was no anger. He said, "I can't do that." He said, "I wish you good luck." He said, "Our very qualified attorneys, both here and in Chicago and in Florida, tell us that in Florida, when a seller takes back a purchase money mortgage, which you did, and which is part of the financing of the sale, there is no entitlement to a deficiency judgment if we foreclose, and we must follow the advice of our attorneys."
And what did you respond to that?
I said, "Well, in all due respect, I don't agree with that conclusion. Is it all right if I send you the lawsuit in the mail without having the sheriff serve it? We truly dislike filing this foreclosure, but we have to protect our investors."
And did you end up going to court?
We did.
Hmm.
And we used an economist to prove our overall loss of profits, and the judge ruled that we were entitled to a $350,000 deficiency judgment, which did really represent a loss of profits. My fee was on a contingent basis and came to $117,000. Plus, I had a delightful dinner at Mr. Prosser's club, and their local attorney, Martin Borkin, became a friendly acquaintance of mine.
Well, sounds like a winning situation. What happened next?
Well, now we had the 2,000 acres back.
Mm.
And I knew that Ed Trumpet had gotten his original deal from Dr. Samuel Paul, a proctologist who specialized in rectal surgery. Dr. Paul was a skinny guy with a mean look, more like a scowl. He was a real estate buff, and he acquired a large tract of about 4,000 acres in the city of Parkland. He sold off half, or 2,000 acres, through Dr. Trumpet to his fellow physicians, supposedly at the same price per acre that he had paid. Everyone had been grateful to Dr. Paul. Although he kept the 2,000 better acres, we had 2,000 less desirable acres, but they were still a terrific
deal.
Still,
yeah. It here comes a new offer, right?
You bet. How did you know? Dr. Trumpet now receives a non-negotiable offer of $9,000 an acre from a corporate buyer, Intico, INC, who we are told was also going to buy out Dr. Paul at the same price per acre, which I thought was really nice because I thought Dr. Paul's properties were worth a little more than ours, maybe 10% more.
Yeah.
And then we're going to put 10% down at the time of closing, and the balance, 90% of the purchase price, was to be paid in a long-term, low-interest mortgage. It sounded like a good deal because we would have the income from the mortgage. Dr. Paul contacted Dr. Trumpet and was enthusiastic. A tenfold profit, tenfold, and we would keep all the payments previously made by the Prossers. We hadn't released any property to the Prossers. Dr. Trumpet and I were still a little skeptical. Land prices had been rising. Parkland now had a residential subdivision or two in there, and it was not too far from our property. Zenith, a huge international corporation, was building the entire city of Coral Springs only a few miles south of us. Intico required, as a condition to the deal, total acceptance by all members of our group, and in addition, a release to Dr. Paul to be signed by each of our members.
Why would they insist on a release for Dr. Paul?
That's a good question. That's the question I asked myself right off the back. Why would Dr. Paul get a release from us on a deal that he wasn't involved in? Our group was too elated to worry about the details, but Dr. Trumpet and I were very concerned. Why would a corporate purchaser insist on individual releases for Dr. Paul? Our investors didn't care except for two. Two of them were very, very sharp, smart people. And they raised the same issue with me. And I was able to get the consent. I had a duty to solicit the consents and try to make the deal. And I did. And I couldn't get the two of them to sign off. And they said, we want to know why. What's going on? Something smells here. There's something's rotten in Denmark, as they say.
So what happened after that?
The Interco contract required 100% approval, and here I had two partners, two investors who wouldn't sign. They were concerned about Dr. Paul's integrity and why he, through Interco, would insist on individual releases. They asked me to get to the truth. Neither Dr. Paul nor Interco would discuss the terms. We were told just accept the deal or reject it. The objecting parties directed me to sue.
They had
the right to sue.
It sounds very suspicious. I don't know much about much, but it sounds fishy.
It did. And I sued. And I sued Interco, and I sued Dr. Paul. And Dr. Paul's attorneys slid into some vicious litigation with us. And the litigation revealed that Dr. Paul had been approached by Interco, who intended to make an offer for the entire property, 4,000 acres. Dr. Paul's and ours, at $14,000 an acre. Dr. Paul told the buyer that the contract was to be realigned and split so that he, Dr. Paul, would get $19,000 for his property, and our group would only get $9,000 for our property. He would get $10,000 an acre more for his. And on 2,000 acres, that's millions of dollars.
So what did you do when you found out about this?
We sued Dr. Paul for fraud. And Dr. Paul hired a very famous lawyer. Waldo Gray. That's not his real name. he just passed away not too long ago, and a few years ago. Everyone's died. Everyone in the story died. I could write the story any way I want.
You got a point.
Waldo Gray was the grandson of a famous Supreme Court, United States Supreme Court justice. And he was a nasty, vicious, devious, and slimy. He was as bad as Dr. Paul. And the facts came out from the buyer's executives, Interco. They sensed that they would be facing a claim for collusion and conspiring to commit the fraud, and they withdrew the offer. But Dr. Paul had to pay some very serious damages, and everyone found out what a schemer and scoundrel he was. To Dr. Trumpet, Dr. Paul became a mortal enemy.
So what happened?
Of course, Dr. Paul made Dr. Trumpet look foolish.
Yeah.
Because here he is, doubling up on his money and giving Dr. Trumpet dishonest facts that Dr. Trumpet shared with everybody, and they all said thank you to Dr. Paul when he was defrauding us. Well,
so
now the
happened?
Property's back on the market.
Okay. And then what?
Well, this is a saga, huh?
Yeah.
The story of Parkland. It's a true story. It's an amazing story. What happens, the history of property is a very interesting study. Anyhow, Dr. Paul died. And he died a much maligned and disrespected person. His own family rejected him, and he was entombed alone in a mausoleum. In this Jewish cemetery that's down in the southwest area, southwest 21st Street or something, and 80th Avenue in Miami. And it's on a lake. I think it's called Lakeside. And in fact, my parents were interred there. And one of the reasons that they liked it was all the Jewish doctors were interred there. And they had a view of the lake from the grave sites. So Dr. Trumpet had been making arrangements for his own funeral. And after having divorced his wife, Nikki, he was looking for a space in the mausoleum. The cemetery told Dr. Trumpet that they had a marvelous spot for him. And Dr. Trumpet bought all the places in the mausoleum, but for the one person who was already resting there. almost a year later, he learned that it was his arch enemy, Dr. Paul.
Oh, my goodness.
He was going to be interred with Dr. Paul.
Wow, what a coincidence there.
Yeah, they would reside side by side forever. Or would they? Or would they? Not Ed Trumpet. No way. Ed Trumpet got out of that deal. He really gave them the dickens. He said, you should have told me who it was.
Yeah.
Anyhow, the next I get a call from Mr. Gerhard Gunderson.
Mm. Okay,
now,
who's that?
I'm sitting in my office, you know, and the deal is dead with Interco.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's dead. And all the people who are in the deal are now in their 80s and they're retired and they're trying to use the income from this property to supplement their retirement income.
Right.
And they're getting nothing. And we're getting taxed. And wait till I tell you the story about how we got taxed. Remind me to tell you what we did with the taxing, because that's a fascinating story in and of itself. So I get a call from Gerhard Gunderson.
Mm-hmm. Who's that?
He was the president of Zenith of Florida, and he had a heavy Scandinavian accent.
Oh.
He was Swedish.
Mm.
It turned out to be Swedes are very funny people.
Yeah.
they you can talk to them, and they're very stiff and formal. And you get a few drinks with them, and they're not stiff and formal at all. They're very charming and nice. He says, Mr. Ress, I would like to talk to you about your client's property in Parkland. I said, certainly, Mr. Gunderson, but if it's to acquire the property, you should be talking to Dr. Trumpet or Dr. Lustig, the co-trustees. I don't have power to discuss the terms of sale of the property. They're the co-trustees.
Right, right. Wow, this is some story. What happened? Well, what do you say to that?
Mr. Gunderson says to me, I know just what I'm doing, sir. I wish to speak to you.
Oh.
This is a personal matter. Can you visit with me at my office in Coral Springs?
Yeah, I can see where this is going. Here we go again, right?
Yeah, well, I couldn't say no. I had a duty to my clients. So I went to see Mr. Gunderson. Yeah. And we made an appointment, and I was invited into what appeared to be a small two-story ballroom with a polished black marble desk the size of a huge conference table.
Wow.
And Mr. Gunderson was sitting behind it. His hair was styled. He was manicured. He was wearing a double-breasted Armani suit.
Hmm.
His shirt was Ascot Chang. I could see Ascot Chang made these wonderful shirts. I used to get them with your initials on them, form-fitting and everything. It was about $125 a shirt.
What?
And
wow.
In those days, that was like, can put a zero at the end of it.
Yeah.
And he had Bulgari cufflinks. I could see his shoes. I couldn't see his shoes, but I'm sure they were pretty fancy.
Mm-hmm.
There was no doubt that he ran the show for Zenith. He was a power. He was dressed as a power
man. He dressed like a power dresser, huh?
He was a power dresser. You can tell.
Yeah.
In business. The other day, I went to see an orthopedist with my wife, and he was wearing an Ascot Chang shirt with cufflinks and his initials on the cuffs. You can tell. It's a statement.
Mm-hmm.
He's examining you in an orthopedic exam in his office. And you can see that he's a very, very successful doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow.
What did he say?
He said, well, we are in fact interested in acquiring your client's property, but I will not have direct dealings with them, particularly your Dr. Trumpet. Amongst other things, he is known as a deal killer. He believes that no matter what an offer may be made, it is insufficient because the buyer would never make the purchase price or pay the purchase price unless he was able to make a significant profit, and therefore the property is always worth more than any offer.
Hmm.
I will not negotiate with that mentality. Well, Dr. Trumpet is right. I mean, people don't, unless they have a reason for buying it,
it has a particular strategy.
And that's what the situation was here. This guy was developing the property down the road.
Exactly.
And he was not buying it as a speculator the way we had it.
Mm-hmm.
He was buying it to use it to develop, to build homes.
Yep.
So that's a different story. But Dr. Trumpet couldn't adjust to that.
Mm.
And I knew that. So he said, we know who you are, Mr. Ress, and we will not negotiate with anyone else but you.
Oh.
Evidently, I had a reputation of being reasonable. If I may, Mr. Gunderson, I will advise my clients and get back to you.
So what was the result? What happened there?
Dr. Trumpet was not amused. He stated that he personally did not want to sell a share at this point in time for tax reasons. Hmm. He instructed me not to negotiate or even pass any offer on to him or to Dr. Lustig. The property was not for sale at this time.
Oh, and so what did you do?
I said, Ed, you know, you don't have a choice. You are a trustee for compensation. There is no higher duty under the law. You have a contract, an agreement that says that you will solicit sales, that you not only will not refuse to negotiate, but that you will go out and seek buyers.
Mm-hmm.
You have an obligation to actively seek buyers, not just to communicate offers, but to actively promote the sale of the property. There are widows and older retired doctors who have good reason to want to sell the property right now while they are still alive and have a great need for the money. You cannot do what is best for you personally at their expense. You've got to do what you're getting compensation for.
How did he react to that?
He went wild. He said, Lewis, don't you tell me what my obligations are. You will do as I instruct. As a matter of fact, you are fired. Who does that sound like?
Oh, wow.
That sounds like former President Trump. If he doesn't like what you tell him, he fires
you're fired. You're fired.
So
what happened next after that?
This is some story, huh?
Yeah, for real.
Well, I spoke to Dr. Lustig, the other trustee. I had to tell him what was going on.
Yeah.
Dr. Lustig was not happy with Dr. Trumpet's action. Mm. He said, Lewis, you are not fired. I am a co-trustee, and I say you are to seek an offer from Zenith, which I will pass on to the investors. Also, I personally am interested in selling.
And what happened next?
Well, I had no choice. I had to follow the instruction of Dr. Lustig.
Right.
And my ethical obligations. And so I called back Mr. Gunderson,
mm-hmm.
and told him that I would meet with him and would discuss it. And I suggested that he come to my office.
Hmm.
And he was a big shot. I mean, he comes to your office in a limo with a driver.
Right.
Next, Mr. Gunderson agrees to come to my office.
Mm.
I knew that Zenith then had a sincere interest in acquiring our property.
Mm-hmm.
And he came in, and we talked price and terms, and he knew that the last buyer had walked away from a $14,000 an offer for the acreage,
uh-huh.
$14,000 an acre. He stated after pressuring his board of directors, he would match the deal, but only with a long-term, low-interest mortgage, just like the Interco deal.
Yeah.
And with the condition that we cooperate and that together, but at our expense, we obtain rezoning of the property to a minimum of 2 houses per acre with some commercial lots to serve the community. And we would be required to accept Zenith's development plan and release lots from the mortgage as they selected at the same rate per acre as they paid for the property.
Oh, okay.
And that's one for one. That's not good.
Mm,
and the closing would be held up until the rezoning was complete. So they would put the money down,
mm-hmm.
and then we'd have to rezone, and there would be no closing until they got it rezoned. And we were guaranteeing the rezoning.
Yeah, that's
we
not good for you,
right? We became business partners. I don't like that.
Yeah. It sounds complicated.
Not simple.
Yeah.
It's a very complicated deal, and negotiating is a different thing from transmitting offers and drawing agreements.
Mm.
If you negotiate and you push too hard, the buyer may take a walk and walk away from the deal. If you don't press for your terms, the client, and in this case, I was part owner, would suffer.
Yeah.
If you take too long, the buyer may lose interest or have financial reasons to withdraw.
Right. Mm-hmm.
If you push too hard, they may think you're anxious and refuse to budge. So you're stuck. You're in trouble.
Yeah. You sound as though you were in trouble at that moment.
I was. Yeah. I was going crazy. I wasn't sleeping nights. Dr. Trumpet wouldn't even talk to me.
Hmm.
He hired a new lawyer, Robert Lowenstein, the husband of one of his major plastic surgery patients, to represent him.
Hmm.
Ed had redone Mrs. Lowenstein from her scalp to her toes. She was a great source of business, recommending him to everyone who would listen. I mean, she was really...
Yeah.
She must have had...
A lot of work.
Two or three facelifts, eye lifts, breast lifts, everything.
And what did Lowenstein do?
He told Dr. Trumpet that a trustee didn't have to seek the sale of the property, and he didn't even have to transmit offers. Mr. Lowenstein told him anything that Dr. Trump had wanted to hear, including that not only was I wrong, but I was a disloyal ingrate.
Wow.
This was Lowenstein's tactic, to turn Dr. Trumpet against me and at all costs prevent Dr. Trumpet, Dr. Lustig, and me from reconciling. And he worked at it.
Hmm.
Trumpet and Lowenstein refused to have dinner with Lustig and me to discuss the resolution of our positions. Dr. Trumpet wouldn't even talk to me. My relation with my dear friend, Dr. Trumpet, was never the same.
That's terrible.
He and his wife were our best friends.
Yeah, that's
and
rough.
We never could go all the way back. Of course, he divorced his wife, who was my wife's best friend, and I was not happy, and he physically smacked her around.
Oh.
And I had to go disable his pistols. I had to
Goodness.
Take the trigger mechanisms out to make sure that he didn't shoot her.
Oh, my gosh.
And her eye was black and blue and everything. She had a concussion.
Oh.
And he never forgave me for taking the trigger out of his weapons.
But, I mean...
That was very symbolic masculine
yeah,
symbolism.
Yeah, but still, you did the right thing,
Lewis. So I got in big trouble with him. And we didn't get back together until he died. And he was on he was being fed through his stomach and he had a brain tumor. I'll tell you more about that.
Oh, goodness. Yeah, it sounds like you were getting into more and more trouble, huh?
I was. And finally, Mr. Gunderson called, and he seemed reluctant to negotiate with me. Even though we weren't about to rezone the property to Zenith specifications without plenty of cash being irrevocably paid at a closing, I wasn't going to, with no closing, rezone the property.
Yeah, and so what finally happened?
They were going to give us a plan, you know, with all the layouts of all the lots and blocks.
Exactly.
And I wasn't going to do that.
Yeah.
So what happened was it seems that good luck finds me when I am most in need.
Yes.
Because a call came in on my private line. I had a private phone. And the caller said that it was a confidential call about the Zenith deal. And he asked if it was a secure phone line. I said, yes, it was. He said, I'm a manager with Zenith. And I'm loyal to my company, but I have family here in Coral Springs, and I have a reason to want Zenith to purchase your client's property. I want to stay here in the Parkland area where my children are in school and have friends and not move to the West Coast, and within reason, I will help you make this deal. But you must never reveal that you are receiving information from me. You have to promise that you will never try to find out who I am, and that if you do and you find out who I am, you will never reveal it to anyone.
Wow, what did you say to that?
Well, it made sense to me. I didn't think I was violating any rules. And he was calling me.
Mm-hmm.
And it could take 30 years to develop the land. And so his story made sense.
Yeah.
And I knew that I wasn't paying him anything. And I didn't solicit him. So I said, okay, I promise.
Okay.
And if it was
what did you
trick,
think about that?
Well, I thought, well, it could be a trick of Gunderson's.
Yeah.
But in any event, it wasn't going to change what I was going to recommend
right.
as a sales price. I had already set the number in my head, in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a good idea sometimes to set a number in your mind before you negotiate. And then you know that you're not going to cross that mark.
Yeah. That's a good strategy. Yeah.
And I figured it couldn't hurt as long as it wasn't illegal and unethical.
Mm-hmm.
And I would ask nothing, but I would only listen.
And did you hear from the insider?
Sure enough, he called me,
hmm.
and the insider, and he said, Gunderson acts tough, but they really want your property. They'll pay a good bit more than they're offering, and you can eliminate any conditions that make the deal contingent. You can safely ask for $25,000 an acre, and they won't blink an eye. I'll call you again.
Hmm.
So he was giving me a starting point.
Yeah.
Where sometimes if you ask for too much,
right.
they turn around and walk away.
Yeah.
And if you ask for too little, you get stuck with that.
Yeah.
So you want to start with a number that you can adjust from that's not going to frighten them away.
Mm-hmm.
He gave me the number,
mm-hmm.
which was fine with me.
I'm intrigued to see who this person is.
What?
I'm intrigued about who this person is.
Yeah. Well, and so it went back and forth. The phone calls from my anonymous source.
Yeah, and did the negotiations continue?
Oh, yeah. Zenith was up to $17,000 an acre, you
wow.
know, from 14. And they only wanted a cooperation clause for the rezoning, and that would occur only after the closing. Mortgage releases would be at 125% of the price per acre, which is much better. That's a safety factor on releases. And the release parcels had to be connected along a contiguous property border to avoid checkerboarding. You know, they could checkerboard, pick a piece here and a piece there and chop up your property on the releases. Mm-hmm. But if they have to be all in a line, one next to along a border, that trims it, you cut your property down, but it makes it, the remainder of your property is still usable.
Right. Okay. And what was left to settle then at that point?
Well, it went okay. It would take 50 more minutes to fully describe to you the ongoing give and take sessions I had with Zenith. Zenith was intentionally dragging out the negotiations. My inside advisor, my inside contact, kept encouraging me. I was down to $22,000 an acre, and they were at 18.
And what did the insider say?
Well, the insider said, he called me, said, they'll pay more, but they won't make Zenith liable on the mortgage note. In other words, they were going to take it in a different company.
Oh, okay.
I called Mr. Gunderson. I said, Mr. Gunderson, I have full authority to negotiate, but I have to sell this deal to the investors. And Dr. Trumpet is out to kill me and kill the deal, no matter what it takes. In one final effort, I will split the difference in the price at $20,000 an acre, but it has to be all cash. And that way, I don't have to concern myself about the mortgage terms, interest, releases, rezoning, and other issues, which just makes it a very difficult deal to explain and thus to sell to our investors. And with Dr. Trumpet saying, no, 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 it's a lousy deal, don't do it, kill it, and he brought everyone in, he invited right. everyone into the deal, they all were loyal to him.
Exactly, they're going to listen to him.
I was in a very difficult spot.
So what did Zenith say to that?
Well, Mr. Gunderson said, I'm terribly sorry, Mr. Riss. Zenith has gone as far as it can go.
Oh, no.
I said, oh, boy, after all of this, losing my friendships and everything, I said, I'm sorry. It looks like no deal. And I was pretty down in the dumps. And the phone rings.
Oh, okay.
And it's my guy.
Yeah, your guy.
He says, stick to your guns. $20,000 an acre, all cash. Gunderson is about to receive an accounting report showing that we have more than enough cash to make the deal. And the home office in Pittsburgh is, according to my friends there, about to instruct him to make the deal.
Okay.
2 days later, Mr. Gunderson calls. He says, wow, Mr. Riss, you seem to know a lot. He says, Mr. Riss, draw the papers. We have an agreement. Now you get it approved by your group.
Okay. Another phase.
$20,000 an acre, all cash, wasn't hard to sell, despite Dr. Trumpet's telling everybody who would listen that the property was worth more. Kenny Lustig proposed that I be paid $175,000 in recognition of my negotiating efforts to get the deal, in addition to my legal fee. 49% of the group approved of that, but Dr. Harry Cantor, his real name is Kaufman, Dr. Harry Kaufman, my children's pediatrician, and he knew me quite well, and I knew him quite well. He had the deciding 2%, and he wouldn't go along and pay me the fee because of pressure from an eye doctor, an ophthalmologist, who sent him patients. The eye doctor just happened to hate all lawyers except his own. You know, there are some doctors that hate lawyers. And he was bending to pressure from Dr. Trumpet, and he would not relent, and Harry Kaufman wouldn't move, and 2% killed the deal, and I didn't get my fee.
Oh, no.
I lost $175,000.
Oh, no.
So there was no special fee for me.
Did you end up closing?
Oh, yeah, we closed. Kenny Lustig then paid me a $135,000 legal fee for handling the closing.
Okay.
I also owned 1.5% of the entire deal, which came to an additional profit of $570,000.
Definitely not a bad deal, right?
No, I came up with about $700,000.
Yeah. So what was the sequel?
Well, years later, but only recently, Harry Kaufman, or Harry Cantor, called a couple of my friends, the elderly pediatrician, and he thanked them profusely for hosting him at a lovely dinner party. He didn't seem to be upset when they told him that the dinner party hadn't occurred yet, but was next week. And he forgot then. The next week, he forgot to show up.
Oh, okay.
So he died.
Oh.
He shortly died thereafter.
Oh, no. And what about Lowenstein?
Robert Lowenstein, that conniving son of a bitch. he was the first one to die.
Oh.
And I don't celebrate anyone's death. I don't wish death on anybody. Nobody, not even Mr. Putin. But I didn't grieve. I did not grieve.
And what happened to Dr. Trumpet?
Dr. Trumpet. Dr. Trumpet sold off the units in the mausoleum. They bought them back. They bought them out of the mausoleum, the cemetery. Mm-hmm. And he died. And he was placed in his own vault. I was at his funeral. Mm. He suffered complications when they inserted a shunt into his skull to relieve pressure on the brain.
Oh.
He had encephalitis. And he degenerated over 3 years to the point where he couldn't recognize anyone. He couldn't talk. And he had to be fed through a tube.
Oh, goodness.
But when he could somewhat function, he seemed to be friendly to me. Mm-hmm. I used to visit him. He was living right in my condo building. He moved in. And he was just on a different floor. And I went to see him. And he was really a very dear old friend. And he was an extremely intelligent man who volunteered to help the wounded in Israel when they had the war. He raised anyone who was burned. He went over and helped and taught burn treatment. He raised funds for the hospital there. He formed a successful hospital here, Palmetto General Hospital.
Oh, yeah.
And he was very highly regarded as a plastic surgeon. In addition, he subscribed to a tax service, and he knew more tax law than many of the tax lawyers. Parkland, in a great part, caused us to lose our friendship. Frankly, it wasn't worth it.
I know.
It
I know.
Not worth
that's,
it.
That's
money
terrible.
Comes and goes, but you know, friendships are something special.
Those connections, yeah. And what about Dr. Lustig?
Kenny Lustig. His real name is Kenny Luxenberg. He knew what was coming. He had inherited a cancer problem which caused him to lose an eye early in life.
Oh.
So he had only one eye. He was very cool, very formal. He was a one-eyed brain surgeon, probably the only one in the world.
Wow.
He also had many sophisticated interests, including collections of fine rugs, oil paintings, and stamps. We were very close friends. He hugged me. He was not the kind of guy that hugs you.
Mm-hmm.
You're lucky to get a handshake. He would never discuss, like all neurosurgeons, he was staid. He would never discuss his vision with anyone else. He was very personal, very private. He was just, neurosurgeons are like that. Over 50% of their patients die while under treatment. Mm. So they had tough people.
Yeah.
All the doctors will tell you that they're crazy. He asked me if his false eye matched. He would never do that with anybody. People couldn't believe that story.
Mm-hmm.
He spent the last 30 days of his life visiting me in my office in the morning, sipping coffee with me, and I would just cancel everything while he was there. And he hugged me every morning, and he's buried right near my parents
in
the same cemetery I told you, Lakeside.
Mm-hmm.
And I go down there once in a while. I used to go often, and I would go put a stone on my parents' grave and on his too.
And what does the stone represent?
The stone, well, that's to say that you were there. Mm. Somebody visited you, and they leave a stone. Mm. That's a Jewish tradition. Mm. Yeah, no one ever asked me about that.
Yeah, because, you know, typically there's flowers, but I had never heard about the stone.
No, you put a stone on the gravestone.
I like it better because the flowers die and,
it's
you know.
It's a beautiful thing.
I love the stone. It's more permanent, you know.
Right.
What about the city of Parkland and the informant? Did you ever find out who that person was?
Well, Parkland, as you know, is now a thriving city.
Yes.
It's gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
The beautiful homes that we bargained about have been built. Well, maybe there's one person who moved into Parkland who knows the real story of how the property came to be developed. His kids are probably finished with college by now, and I'm sure he's ready to retire if he hasn't already retired from Zenith.
Mm-hmm.
And I never found out who it was.
Never,
and
wow.
And never sought to find out.
Yeah.
I felt I had to
didn't
keep my
know.
Word and not even try to find out who it was.
That's crazy. That's
he
crazy.
He accomplished his mission.
Yeah, he sure he did.
He did a service.
Yes.
It was a beautiful thing that he did.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, it's quite a saga. So let's take a look at everything that we talked about. There's a great deal to be learned here. Where do we start? We've got ethics, business practices, the art of negotiation, corporate spying, personal interests of those in power. Where do you want to get started with?
Well, I guess you covered it all. And have a nice day. No, the Parkland deal, I'm going to, because this is, I'm sure, running quite long, I'm going to abbreviate my comments on this deal.
Okay.
Because this story speaks for itself, and you don't need me to tell you about what went on with the farmers starting out, the farmers trying to connive and defraud the city slickers.
Yeah.
And the whole thing is a history of one person after the other trying to connive and defraud.
Yeah.
And at the end, the property gets developed.
Mm-hmm.
So, which is good.
Yeah.
Dealing with people in power, you know, you have to be so tactful. You can't tell them what you want to tell them sometimes. You got to tell them what they want to hear.
Mm.
And that's so much the case today when you have these papers coming out of the archives and being taken by an ex-president. While he was president, he took them. So it's a complicated legal problem.
Hmm.
And he wants to hear that he has the power to declare them declassified.
Hmm.
And he's going to hire attorneys who tell him that. And then he's going to say, I relied on my attorneys. So that's using your attorneys as a...
scapegoat.
No, using them as a tool to justify... But what you want to hear from them and say, I relied on them.
Right.
So you can't have, when you're conspiring to commit a crime, you can't have your attorneys conspire with you and then claim privilege with them.
Yeah.
So the attorneys can testify that it wasn't their idea, it was the client's idea.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first thing. If you look around, dictators tend to kill all of their rivals.
Mm.
So people destroy, if you don't tell somebody what they want to hear, and you're a rival.
True, yeah. Stalin was big on that.
Yeah, so, yeah. You know, you take guys like Genghis Khan, you know how many people he killed?
Oh, I'm sure quite a lot.
60 million, they figure. Ooh. And you know who else was a terrible killer? Mao Zedong.
Hmm.
I figured he killed 45 million.
Wow.
You know, with the Great Leap, you know. And Stalin.
Oh, yeah, he
Stalin,
topped it.
And Hitler. Each did away with 6 to 20 million.
Mm.
And, of course, you had Deep Throat. Remember Deep Throat, who was the informant?
Yes.
So that was with the Nixon
with the
administration.
Nixon, yeah. Watergate.
So sometimes you have informants helping you.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have much of a choice. I couldn't kill the deal ethically. I had to pursue it.
Yeah, you're in the middle of it.
And a client tells you to do something unethical or that you think is illegal, you can't do it, no matter what the client tells you.
Mm-hmm.
You have to run like crazy, usually, and get away from it. But I had Dr. Lustig telling me that I couldn't do that. He wasn't discharging me, and that I was to pursue my obligations. And I, a lot of people were relying on that income.
Right.
I had an ethical duty to go forward.
Hmm.
But, of course, Dr. Paul was involved in conspiring to commit fraud with Interco, and Interco was involved in conspiring to commit fraud. They could face criminal charges.
Mm-hmm.
But the state's attorney's office is not interested in pursuing your vendetta.
Right.
They get called maybe 5 times a day by people. Maybe attorneys who would like to use them as a tool to expedite a civil settlement and have criminal charges preferred against the defendant,
mm-hmm.
the people they're suing. And so they got to be very careful not to do that. So I was talking about fraud. There's an attorney I knew who was engaged in fraud. I won't tell you his name, but he sold land that he didn't own. He would getting a contract from people to buy the land, and then he would go out and try to acquire it.
Wow.
So he was agreeing to sell it, that he didn't own it, and then he would go out to try to buy it. If he could buy it, then he could sell it. So that's not flipping an option. That's that's not getting an option and then signing the option.
Right, no.
That's something else. Mm-hmm. He got disbarred for that. You can't sell stuff that you don't own.
No.
So you have this labyrinth of intrigue, dishonesty, spying, internal backstabbing with the Mr. Lowenthal, how he was out to get me.
Mm-hmm.
He had a personal interest in keeping the client away from resolving his differences with me. That was unethical. Of course, I could have sent a bill for my negotiating, but that's not legal services, although it might be considered it. And I was told by Dr. Lustig to do that,
right.
But I knew that they wouldn't pay it anyhow. I'd have to litigate, and I didn't want to sue the people that are my own clients on a fee. That's not fun. So that's the story of spying in business and corporate espionage. It goes on in China a lot, where they steal the business information, the secrets, corporate secrets. Then you have the discussions of transactions like Martha Stewart with insider information, you know, insider trading.
Yeah.
So you can't do that. She was accused of insider information and she lied about it. I think she was 5 months in prison.
Yeah.
And then she had 5 months of house arrest and 2 years of probation. That damaged her a lot.
Mm-hmm.
She's a changed person. You don't want that.
Yeah.
So Parkland worked out for everyone's benefit. They got 22 times their investment, and so did I.
Yeah,
that
good.
That's great.
That's great, Lewis. I mean, wow. What a history, right? What a history of Parkland and just everything that resulted in its development, and learned quite a lot. So thank you so much for sharing that with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We are excited to announce that Lewis now has his own blog. Visit lewisrest.com to get insightful commentary to the Miami Memoirs podcasts, along with an analysis of current events, as only Lewis can provide.